I am from St. Tammany Parish. I'm from just in between Slidell Incorporated and Lacombe Incorporated, a place called Bayou Vincent or Bayou Vincent. My family has been there since the 1770s. And I am, my people in the north are actually part of the Cato tribe, and my people in the south are actually part of Choctaw, and then I'm black and Creole and all kinds of stuff. I'm just regular gumbo here for Louisiana. But I'm also really tied to this place. This place means a lot to me. I would never have called myself an environmentalist because I grew up hunting and fishing, but you know, conservation was definitely a part of my life. But I didn't think of like hugging trees and saving polar bears as something that I wanted to do. But when I figured out that keeping those alligators and keeping my ecosystem safe and keeping my family and my community safe from flooding and storms was actually part of this same fight, I realized I just might be in this broader movement for climate justice. My work began in Katrina. I started in corporate law. I guess we're all villains at some point, right? But when I saw how recovery was playing out in South Louisiana, and who got to recover, and who got access to certain things, as a lawyer, you could just see it wasn't quite right. And sometimes it would break down across race lines, but I'm also from a very wealthy, mostly white parish. So I got to come into New Orleans and see how the exact same state regulations were being implemented in different parishes. And those things were, they caused a lot of questions for me as an attorney. And it is from there that we started opening up legal clinics and opening up legal shops to literally get folks through the recovery process or the legal paperwork of it, and then to politicize people into the movement. So that was a process that we used through the Gulf Coast Center for Law and Policy, and we'll continue to do that with the U.S. Human Rights Network. I don't think I have to say much about the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Title VI portion, except to say we're having this conversation rooted in a law that existed because for generations and years and hundreds of years, there were discriminatory, legally sanctioned practices against people. And while we can have deep discussions about case law, which is important, it's also important for us as lawyers and legal workers to really understand the context of the country that we live in, the context of the actions that folks are doing, so industry, even law. It is the law that we, most of us, have been sworn to or have taken oath to uphold. Those of you who have not yet taken that oath, you'll be taking an oath to uphold a system that has absolutely oppressed and even dehumanized people. And this is something for you to consider because it means your job won't be easy. How do you work within a system? How do you claim a system that is absolutely creating the things on your good days you're going to be working against? This is something to grapple with. It's something to challenge yourself to think about. The Civil Rights Act, Title VI, we're going to have some conversation, but let's not forget there was a civil rights movement that led to this. There were people who died, there was bloodshed, there were things in place that we should be, you know, really conscious that don't get re-implemented, especially in this current administration. So it's rooted, the Title VI is rooted in understanding race discrimination. And here's the interesting thing about race. Race is actually not real. It's a social construct. It is not rooted in biology or fact or science. It's not real. So we have a whole body of law, generations of oppression, systems in place against this thing that is not real. Now we're asking you to do the impossible. Break down the thing that doesn't exist. Eradicate the thing you can't see. And when we get to, talking about like, are people doing it on purpose or do we just see a disparate intent? Now it gets even more complicated, right? Can we see some direct intention? But let me just tell you that the last piece about the race discrimination is that there was a quote when I was doing some research about this topic. There was a quote early on in implementing this Title VI. The quote says, there's no basis for combining environmental law and employment law. This is when they were discussing the disparate impact. There's no basis for combining environmental law and employment law concepts. So not just should this law, as Professor Hardy said, not just should this law attack the thing that happens on purpose, but it should attack the thing that happens, that produces this disparate impact. That disparate impact argument is pulling two sectors together, two legal notions together. I just want to address this quote. There's no basis for combining environmental and employment law concepts. Except there is. In this country, in fact, it might be the two legal concepts that come together first. Certainly, the two legal concepts that have the most to do with the power and the wealth and the existence of what we see as our country right now. And I'm talking about labor, and I'm talking about environment, and since we're in the South, let me just say it out loud, I'm talking about a slave system where labor and environment were absolutely put together. It wasn't employment law because we used the law to dehumanize people. So there were no labor rights, so to speak, but we are talking about work. We are talking about environment, and we're talking about them together. And so when the critique comes of Title VI that we can't put these pieces together, we actually have to step back and be honest about the foundation of this country, which puts them together initially and as a foundation of the wealth and where we are today. Slavery was the original extractive economy. The original extraction, the process by which we do a lot of our extraction in this country is rooted in slavery. We took people out of Africa, we extracted them, and we did not replace or renew anything in Africa. We simply used them up for our own benefit, and it has created the wealth in the US even today. The wealth that we're fighting about and talking about is not because we all worked really hard to get to where we are. That is not the basis of what you are reaping right now. Yes, it's really great when people can dedicate a building. No, they didn't develop all of that wealth themselves. And so it's really hard because nobody, who wants to talk about slavery? Nobody. Who wants to talk about race? Not me. But these are the things you have to have in your analysis, especially if you're going to go attack some of these issues that can get caught up in the details and really miss the forest for that one tree. So I want to bring the forest back in. Because it's these extractive economies, and this process that have led us to the current climate crisis. Extraction of people has now turned into extraction of oil and gas. And really using these things up to a place where they cannot be replenished has got us in a crisis that is not just facing South Louisiana, which, by the way, we are losing land at the fastest rate on the planet in South Louisiana. But it's not just South Louisiana, it's the entire globe facing a climate crisis. So this US economic extractive process is what we actually have to have the courage to attack. And it's the attack and the strategy of the attack that interests me most, and the question of Title VI and how it plays out in the future as we confront the climate crisis is really what I'm hoping we can get into. One other thing before I move fully on to climate change is that the Title VI portion there's often a conversation around race discrimination and or equal protection. Again, it's the same point. We don't have to get into the details of the Equal Protection Clause, but what I will say is that the Equal Protection Clause itself comes out of another Civil Rights Act. We are now dealing with laws that are trying to put band-aids on a broader system that built the wealth of this country but broke our country in a lot of different ways. And I want to mention, you cannot substitute low-income communities when these sections are specifically talking about race communities. You don't get to say, are we using Title VI for the low-income people of South Louisiana? You have to say, this Title VI is meant specifically for the race categories enumerated. We are not talking about just low-income. However, let me just be clear, in America, just in case you wanted to know if the argument of race versus class was really an argument, it's not. If you're a particular race in this country, you can predict your class very easily. This is, you don't shift to class You will avoid the very difficult topic of race. And it is race that is enumerated in Title VI. And it is race that is the root of a lot of these civil rights acts. But, as Robert said, what idiot would tell you they're discriminating against a race on purpose? Well, it turns out we have such an idiot who will just say that on purpose. I don't know that any of us were anticipating that kind of like ridiculousness. And I never thought I would be talking about like someone who just said stuff. Instead, I generally talk to folks about a concept called structural racism. Structural racism. And Professor Hardy alluded to this, which is there are times when there are laws and policies that are race neutral. I love it, I'm talking to a whole group of legal people. Race neutral. Race neutral laws and policies, but they have a disparate impact. They impact people differently. Structural racism says there is a system that operates like that across the board, not just environmental law, in all kinds of areas of law. In fact, the Aspen Institute says structural racism is a system in which public policies, laws, institutional practices, cultural representations, and other social norms work in various, often reinforcing ways to perpetuate racial group inequity. Structural racism, this is structural racism. It identifies dimensions of our history and culture that have allowed privileges associated with whiteness and disadvantages associated with color to endure and adapt over time. There is a system that we can't see, a thing that is not real, and we've got to fix it, we've got to break it down, we've got to find it, we've got to root it out, and we've got to fix it. This structural oppression is rooted in laws that never say the word race, but they have very different impacts on races. Race is not real, but it has real consequences. And now we've got to figure it out when the polluters come a-knocking. One more thing on structural racism, just quickly. It's a subtle racialized pattern in policies and practices that go throughout the political, economic, and social cultural structures of America. Structural racism generates differences in well-being between people of color and whites. Structural racism maintains the existing racial hierarchy, even as they adapt with the times or accommodate new racial or ethnic groups. It is the contemporary manifestation of racism, and it lives in laws, policies, and practices. So, I hit the class piece, so I'm just gonna skip down and go to a conversation about climate and industry and when industry comes knocking so that they can pollute in your neighborhood. Generally, the argument for a polluter to come in is what?
Jobs.
Jobs, money, economic stability, economic justice for sure. And the only real place where that argument works has to be in the poorest areas. So right there, you just put David against Goliath, right? You just put in front of people who are hungry, who are struggling, who are trying everything they can to just live, you've just put in front of them the only source generally of economic stability. And you're telling them to choose. And you're telling them to choose, and by the way, it might have some impact in the future, we'll talk about it, but choose today on what you need. That's actually not a fair fight. In fact, that kind of imbalance is part of the structural racism practice that we have to break down. What happens when you let people go even-toe? What happens when people have all the information? What happens when you build a community where people have what they need? And when an industry comes knocking, they can say, no, thank you. We've got enough water and food. We're just fine. It's clean and it's good, and we will not take your industry. What happens when you give a community that kind of ability to fight? I'm not sure that we want to see that, but that's what I'm fighting for. The real question is people over profit. That's the question. And that's the big question in the climate movement as well. The same industries that are polluting EJ communities, communities of color, are tied, are closely dependent on, or the same companies that are emitting massive amounts of greenhouse gases and other things in the air that are accelerating the climate crisis. The bad part is that the EJ movement, generally represented by some black folks yelling and screaming for you to pay attention to the thing that is killing them, and the climate movement, generally represented by white folks saying there's something coming and we don't want it and we're going to march and make really pretty signs, they actually don't talk to each other. They actually don't talk to each other. But the interesting thing is, these same polluters that are killing populations are the same polluters that are killing the climate. And if we choose to bring those two communities together, we just might have ourselves a ball game. But it's gonna require two things. One, we're gonna actually have to understand that intersection of environment and climate. And it's not easy because it gets real technical at some points. We have to understand chemistry, we have to understand seasonal differences, we have to understand engineering, we have to understand law. That means we need everybody. This can't be a movement of social scientists who, you know, can really talk about human rights in a deep, real way. It can't be that or it won't work. We need the hard sciences, and we need innovation, and we need everybody in. The other thing that we need, and this one might hurt a little bit, but I mean it with all the love in my heart. We're going to need those of us who believe the falsehood of expert knowledge. That's everyone in this room, by the way, myself included. We're going to have to figure out a way for the experts to redefine themselves as a people with experience of living next to and in these disaster spaces, and let those of us who have been privileged enough to get the title of expert put on us, we have to learn how to follow. We're gonna have to learn how to follow the people we question, we undervalue, we don't wanna listen to because their grammar isn't good, they're not speaking in the way we want, they're not hitting the bullet points, they're not talking about the stuff that we wanna hear. They need food at the meetings, they need childcare at the meetings, they need you to let them vent about something that happened at work today. We're actually gonna have to figure out how to get behind them. And that's not easy, because if I know you, because I know me, we have the answer. If you just follow me, everyone, we'll be okay. I'm quite bright. I love my strategies. They're beautiful, I have graphs, I have matrices, they're fantastic. But they're mine. And it doesn't work if I simply oppress people who are already being oppressed. It doesn't work if I tell you my idea. It only works if we develop the idea together with everybody all in and everybody equal. That's everybody's life being valued the same across the board. And right now, our lives in this room are valued a little higher than some other lives in the city of New Orleans. And I'm not blaming anyone, and you should not walk out of here feeling guilty. But at some point, we're gonna have to face some hard truths, and we're going to have to change and shift the way that we go about finding solutions. I think Title VI could be an innovative tool in the climate movement. I think going after polluters and making them pay and making sure that we fight every lawsuit we can get our hands on, not because we just want to stop the pollution in this neighborhood, but because we want to stop the emissions to the climate and we want to stop these industries from being valued more than people. This tool can be a very small part of a winning strategy. And that's why I'm interested in the future of Title VI. I don't know what's gonna happen with y'all homeboy in the White House. What I can anticipate is that any law helping people or the environment will be gutted, ignored, or erased. But I think the role of lawyers and legal workers is to challenge that from happening. I think our strategy while we're in the streets should be actually asking for something and pushing what we need at the same time. I think that if we pick up a legal strategy using Title VI and other instruments, we just might be able to play a role that's going to require many sectors to come in on many issues, and we will have just been a part of a broader success. I'm not sure that the current government is going to fund EPA. I'm not sure that the DOJ folks who are supposed to be working on Title VI complaints will be supported. I'm not sure that the backlogs of filings that exist right now will be dealt with. But I say, let's give them more. Let's overrun them. Let's use every tool every day as much as possible. Let's do class projects to just send more and more cases and overwhelm them. I'm not saying that we win in the federal sector. I'm saying we hereby, by overloading them with these instruments, make a case to the international community that what is happening here is a small segment of the US population controlling a bigger piece. And this, friends, is where revolution comes. What we need is wins on the ground. We need engagement on the ground. What we need are friends in the international sector. And this is what we can do. This is a tool. This is a tool. And I think Title VI can be our tool for the revolution. And I think climate justice and environmental justice can finally come together. And I think South Louisiana can be the innovation to make